the more the driver comes in and looks at their trips, the more that they reduce crash risk.
This is the Insurance Technology Podcast, where we bring interesting people from across the insurance ecosystem to discuss and debate technology's impact on the industry. Join us each episode for insights and best practices from industry stewards and tomorrow's innovators. Now, here's your host, Reed Holsworth.
Welcome to the Insurance Technology Podcast. I'm your host, Reed Holsworth. In this episode, I'm going to be interviewing Ryan McMahon. Ryan is the SVP of Strategy and Corporate Development at Cambridge Mobile Telematics. And I want to be honest with you guys. When this came to our attention, Kristen and I talked about this. I said, telematics? I remember selling Progressive policies back in the day and trying to convince insureds to plug that thing called Snapshot into their cars. Doesn't seem that interesting. Well, when I met Ryan and talked to him, look, it is really interesting. It's come a long way. So stay tuned. In this episode, we're going to get to know Ryan, as a kid. We're going to learn how he fell into insurance like many of us. Then we're going to deep dive into telematics and road safety. Really good stuff. Stay tuned. Ryan, welcome.
Thanks for having me, Reed.
Cambridge Mobile Telematics. We're going to get into this. Sounds like something out of a RoboCop movie or something. I'm just kidding. Most people got to know what that is, but we're going to get deep into that. Shows my ignorance around some of this, but I'm really excited about having this conversation. We're going to get deep into some things. But before we do, we always like to learn, you know, about the person, about the human, about yourself, Ryan. So tell us a little about yourself. Where'd you grow up? What were you into? Play some sports? Like, how was Ryan McMahon as a child? Who were you?
Yeah, I'm sure like everyone you have on the podcast, I was reading actuarial review magazines from a young age. I always had a lot of passion for loss reserving. And that in my early days, I grew up in upstate New York, central New York. And it was a really interesting place to grow up as a kid because not close to any major city. So it's not like when people say, oh, I was a Chiefs fan or a Braves fan or a Patriots fan. Like the part of upstate New York that I grew up in, everyone was a Syracuse fan. So I grew up a fan of Syracuse sports, college sports, which was great. And then I ended up going to school at the State University of New York at Potsdam. And here's a funny story. I did a series of radio interviews last year, and I was talking about Potsdam, New York, with a radio station. I think it was in Virginia. And they said, you probably shouldn't tell too many people that you went to SUNY Potsdam. So I don't know if it has some sort of notorious reputation. But the same interview, I mentioned that it was on the Canadian border, which was awesome because at that time, it was pretty easy to get up to places like Ottawa and Montreal and, you know, totally, oh, yeah. It's amazing. You just cross the border and it feels totally different. This radio interviewer, the host said, New York borders Canada, and it does indeed border Canada. I can confirm this. So grew up there, and I wanted to actually go into law enforcement at that time of my life. I was working part-time for the New York State Park Police, and was just waiting. Yeah, I was a park ranger, which was a super cool job. I think the best job
That's my dream job. That's what I wanted to be when I grew up, was a park ranger. I mean, it's awesome.
There's still time. There is still time. So I did that. It was cool. And I was doing it over the summers. And one of the things that happened in that time, though, was I was like always a little bit squeamish around blood and trauma and that kind of thing. And I was like, if I'm going to do this, I need to jump in with 2 feet. So I actually became a New York State EMT at that time. And I volunteered with the Potsdam Volunteer Rescue Squad, which was, I think we had 100 square miles of territory in way upstate New York with not a lot of care close by. So we had a lot of helicopters that came in. And the first call that I ever went to, it was a fatal crash. And it was sister that unfortunately killed her sister because she was intoxicated and the other was unbelted. So it's one of those things that road safety is stuck in my head for a long time. And when I graduated, I was just waiting for the test because the civil service tests come every few years, but I had student loans at that time. So I needed to get a job. And I've applied to like 63 or 64 places. I have a spreadsheet, still have the spreadsheet. I got calls back from two. One of those was AAA, and they offered me a position to answer the phone to help people when they needed help. That's on the side of the road. The other was from Hanover Insurance, offering an opportunity in a claims rotation program. So that moment, I was not a first round draft pick by any means, started as a claims adjuster, but the rotation program was awesome because it gave me so much experience in a super short period of time.
Wow. That's awesome. You know, a lot of people that I've interviewed on this podcast, they talk about the programs that these carriers had to get people in and get people in insurance. And it's pretty amazing, you know, how some of these carriers just brought people in and then boom, you're now stuck, dude, you know? So did you play sports or anything as a kid?
I did. I played lacrosse, and my lacrosse career ended when I realized that the talent level that was around me was like 20x better than me. And I still remember this. We went to a lacrosse tournament one summer, and we were playing against teams from around upstate New York, and lacrosse is a Native American sport. That's really where the sport began. Oh yeah. Played against a team from one of the tribes, and I remember just getting like knocked over all day for the entire day. And it's funny, the team that I played on where I went to school, the kids that were on that team ended up going and playing for national championship teams at multiple levels, at Lemoyne, at SUNY Cortland, and at Onondaga Community College. But an interesting fact about me, and I don't know if this is super well known, but I actually dropped out of high school in my junior year. So I didn't have a senior year, and I spent my senior year washing cars at Bill Rapp Pontiac at the time. So I was a lot boy. I still remember this. My dad said to me, well, you don't have to go to school, but you have to get a job. And at that time I was selling TVs at Sears. And he said, which was super awesome, by the way, because they paid on commission. I didn't even know this at the time. Like, I had no idea. I was just like, whatever. They probably could have paid me a lot less. I said, I have a job because I was working part-time. But my dad said, you need to get a full-time job if you're not going to go to school, thinking that, you know, it would be a short temporary thing. And I went to the car dealership and I said, hey, I want to sell cars. I was 16. and they're like, you can't sell cars, but you can be a lot boy. And I didn't even care what the job was. I just wanted to check that box. So I did that. And that gave me, I spent my senior year working, and it gave me the jolt that I needed because it showed me the path that I was going to go on if I didn't. If I didn't take school more seriously, and if I didn't dedicate my time, and I was like not a good student, I was a C student, D student in high school, and I just never really. I had friends that had dropped out at that time, and I was just like I didn't conform, I guess was the easiest way to say it. But then when I got to college, and I was super lucky that I was able to get into SUNY Potsdam at that point. Because I just was like already ready. Like I saw the other side. I'm like, this is not a path that I want to be on. I do not want to be working, you know, in the middle of the Syracuse winter, brushing snow off a car and whatever other things that entail. You know, for me, I needed that course correction super early on. And I still remember the first semester that I was the U.S. politics class, actually, and I got the syllabus, and I thought that the syllabus was like the homework for the next class. Like, that's how, like, you know, not with it I was at that point. But I was so like, I was like, I need to do really well. So I read like two books before the next class.
Whoa.
And I took college super seriously. I graduated with, I think it was like a 3.97. I was number two in the program, and I studied psychology at that time. And I was just, I took it like super seriously from that point forward. But it was a really important time in my life. And I was very thankful that my parents, as crazy as I'm sure it would be, I was the end of a line of a lot of kids, a big family. And I'm sure that, you know, it was not a good mindset from their perspective, but they knew that this was the right thing for me. They gave me the freedom to fail, I guess, to a certain degree. Yeah. And I was able to take that, and then that just motivated me, and I've been thankful ever since.
Hey everyone, it's Kristen. I'm here to remind everyone that InsurTech Boston is back for 2024. We are going to be live at the House of Blues on May 7th with the doors opening at 1 p.m. So no excuse, because you don't have to be there early. Tickets are available now at InsurTechBoston.com. Hope to see you there.
That's awesome, man. Your story is very similar to mine. In school, I got straight Fs. No joke. Like terrible. I was like the worst student on earth. I didn't skip school. Like a lot of people skip school. Like that were kind of, you know, my kids I hung out with. I was always there because, like, you know, all the kids were there. All the girls were there. Like I would show up, but I just didn't do anything. But same kind of thing, you know, after school, after that, you know, I kind of same situation. I'm like, what am I doing with my life? Like, this is not going to end well. And went to college, same kind of situation, you know, 4.0 GPA, the whole nine. I ended up quitting college, starting a business. I didn't really finish, which I wish I would have, but it's interesting. It, you know, for me, there was that inflection point of like, what am I doing here? Like you said, like, I don't want to be sweeping snow off of cars for the rest of my life. Like, let's do this. So what did you do right after? Did you go right into the park ranger job, or how'd you get after school?
No. So I was working while I was going to school the whole time. So, I knew that I wanted to be in law enforcement at that point. So I think I worked, it was actually the first job I ever got fired at. I was a security guard for, I think it was like JB Hunt or a trucking company. Hey. I fell asleep. I was in the overnight shift and I fell asleep for a truck that was coming in. And I think I got fired the next day. So I was working after I was working at the car dealership, I had like basically kind of like two jobs at a time for a while. And, then when I went to school, I continued to work over the summers. So I knew like law enforcement was super interesting to me because I was always interested in, I didn't realize at the time, but I was always interested in like traffic related things and always interested in road safety. Because it was around the same time of like Fast and the Furious and that kind of era.
Wait, hold on. You watch Fast and the Furious and you're like, road safety. Yes. No more street racing.
I watched the Fast and the Furious and crashed my car. And and after that point, I was like, man, like this is like, you know, this is not going well. Like, you know, I have already now dropped out of high school and I totaled a 1992 Pontiac Bonneville, which is... I flipped it actually. And I'm so lucky. I was the only person in the car and it was a very challenging, maneuver that was in a parking lot of a mall at that time. And it was one of those things at an early point of my life that like, I realized that I was being influenced by everything else around me, that I wasn't like the person that says, this is what I want to do and going to do it. Right. So like, I'm like seeing these movies, I'm like, this is crazy. And then I started to, after that experience specifically, I was like, you know, the law enforcement, the experience I had at that point was scary and I wasn't hurt, but I was transported. I went to the ER and it was super scary. And it was an opportunity for me to then come back and reflect on it. And I'm like, you know what? I think that there's the other side of this is super interesting. And those cop cars are pretty cool. So like, I wanted to get more involved in that side of things. And I had friends that were older that were kind of in that area. And I had an opportunity to kind of see the picture from a different vantage point. And because this whole incident, by the way, happened on private property, there wasn't a law enforcement component to it. So I didn't have a ticket or anything of that nature. It'd be like crashing a car on a race course. But at that time, it was a big deal for me. And my sister had known the captain of the police at that time. And I remember I went to the police station a few weeks later, talked, and I said, you know, I think that this is an opportunity for me to learn something completely different. So I was like, this opportunity was, you know, when I was, I want to say 17, 18 years old. Really? And then I had refocused myself and said, okay, I want to be a New York State trooper. That was the specific goal. But the New York State trooper, the test was only like maybe every like 2 or 3 years, depending on how many people retire and what the needs are at that time. So that was always my goal, but you had to have a certain number of college credits first. So I think it was like 60 credits at that time. But I said, look, I'm going to finish school because I had already had like, I was so embarrassed by the fact that I dropped out of school, Reed, like super embarrassed for years, like probably not until like maybe the last 10 years did I feel comfortable having this conversation in the way that we're having it now, because I felt like I was a failure. And if you think about it, like of the milestones you have in life up into, you know, specific stages, graduating high school is a milestone that everyone looks to as like a obvious achievement point. So if you don't have those achievement points, so that's why I, you know, I was like, I'm going to finish school. I'm going to do as good of a job as possible. And then when the opportunity came around to take the test, I was already promoted like twice in the insurance ecosystem. And I wasn't even living in New York anymore. I was living in New Jersey. So that it was like a good motivational goal to have at that time of my life. But it it was quickly surpassed by the by the glitz and glamour of the insurance industry.
I love it. So, all right. So you're at Hanover. You got promoted twice, right? So then what happened after Hanover? What happened after that, I guess you should say?
Well, it was a rotation program. So just like you said, and by the way, I'm a huge fan of these things. I don't know if anyone actually knows exactly what they want to do when they graduate school. That's not like a specialist that didn't like, you know, specialize into computer engineering or something, you know, super discreet. So these rotation programs were awesome. So I was with a cohort of people that had joined at the same time. So they're all around the same age, like 22 years old. We were all in field offices for Hanover. I was in Syracuse. And then every, I don't know, 6 weeks or 2 months, we would go back to Worcester, Massachusetts, where the headquarters was. And we would learn the policy. We'd read the policy. We would get education. And then we'd go back and do our jobs, which was real world practice. And then when another opportunity opened up, I have to move from PD at that time, property damage, to liability claims. The office was in central New Jersey. So I moved from Syracuse to central New Jersey and got a $2,000 raise and became super poor because the cost of living in upstate New York is minuscule, or at least at that time it was minuscule compared to New Jersey. And I was there. I remember having every night for dinner was like cereal, but not like even the cereal you get at eye level. The cereal you get at like ankle level, you know what I mean? Like in a bag. Oh, totally. Absolutely. Absolutely. But I did save a couple of bucks so I could spend the $13.95 to take New Jersey Transit from central New Jersey to Manhattan every other weekend or so, and explored. And it was awesome. And then this is crazy from a technology standpoint. So Hanover was going through a transition at that period of time. And I forget if it was a Guidewire system or something, but it was a new claim system. And they needed someone to basically be like the guinea pig for the IT team back in Worcester and to work in the field, to work in both systems at the same time. And I was just saying literally yes to everything. So I was like, yeah, I'm happy to do that. So then, you know, I'm now doing two jobs because I'm doing my normal claims job, but then I'm also kind of sorting out how to make this new claim system work from a user perspective. And I got really good feedback and remarks from the technical team in Worcester and the HQ. And they said, hey, I think that you would be a great fit for this other business analyst rotation program, which moved away from claims into the core functionality of product and pricing and underwriting. So I went and moved from New Jersey to Worcester. And that was great because that got me into the headquarters, that got me ingrained with the core business functions. I learned so much in that period of time. I never had used Excel then, and I became like an Excel master under like these two gurus that knew everything. And, you know, talk about like the importance of being in office at that time for me. I got so much feedback and so much learning exposure in that period of time. Probably the biggest kind of learning time in my life was then. And one of the people I worked with had left Hanover to go work at Acadia Insurance and Commercial Lines. And I went there after working at Hanover for a long period of time, doing a ton of jobs. And the last job I did there at Hanover was with agents. So I managed the Connecticut territory, one of, I think, three or four territory sales managers for Hanover at that time. And it was awesome. Being out in the field was a great job, almost on par to the park ranger job. I was with agents, and it taught me so much about the actual like functionality of how, you know, a small business grows and engages with the community and how they compete and the challenges that happen there. And I was able to bring my claims expertise forward. So, you know, I learned the job from the crash level up, which is super useful because, you know, ultimately that's what we're selling in insurance. We're selling a promise that we're going to put you whole if something adverse happens. And a lot of people don't have the opportunity of actually interacting with like the methodology of how that happens, with dealing with someone with a first notice of loss, with dealing with the issues that occur relative to appraisal, inspection, coverage, liability, rental cars, replacement parts if they're not manufactured by the original manufacturer or not. Like it's a crazy world on the claim side. But that was a great learning kind of springboard to everything else.
That's awesome. So then what?
I went to Acadia Insurance. So Acadia is owned by W.R. Berkley, and a really important person to me, Len Ryer, was my boss at Hanover, and he had gotten to take over a branch there in New Hampshire. Len is one of these guys that, you know, just absolute master of the business, incredibly important person, because he not only was a boss to me, but like a very personal mentor and helped me in so many ways in that period of time in my life. And what was cool is I established such a huge friend base from Hanover, because there's so many younger people that were there in these rotation programs. Right. But at that period of time, a lot of people went through the rotation program and then left to other companies. So, you know, that's one of the negative sides. And if you're an insurance company, you're going to put together a rotation program, thinking like past year two or three is super important, because you end up with these super smart, motivated, like alpha motivated people that now want to move up as fast as possible. And sometimes there's not roles. So I at that period of time had like friends everywhere at all the carriers, because everyone kind of spread out. And Len was my boss at that point, went over to Acadia Insurance, which was commercial insurance, still is commercial insurance, owned by W.R. Berkley. And I went and learned commercial. It was the first time that I learned commercial. I was in charge of growing the branch for Acadia, and also ran the affinity programs for them. So got really involved with associations, with different types of businesses, you know, the wider side of the business. But what's fascinating was Acadia was a super, super big loss control organization, meaning they had engineers, they had safety professionals that went out to businesses, loggers, sawmills, like super crazy stuff to work with them to reduce risk. And I was in the position that I could learn from them. And I, you know, was brought back to my roots in Potsdam, and saw the kind of connection from the insurance industry to the safety side. And it was like that period that kind of started the little spark of, hey, maybe there's more to the insurance business than just underwriting and selecting risks, but maybe we can actually change risk at the same time. And that's exactly what Acadia did. And at that period, in my opinion, they were among the best, because they had a huge investment in super professional talent that were focused on understanding what it takes to get people home every day, right? From workers' comp, from a liability perspective, what it takes to get people home. And I was at Acadia for a while. Len had left, and he took a job, I think, at Providence Mutual at that point. And I had an opportunity to go to work at Plymouth Rock, which, if folks aren't familiar, Plymouth Rock is a privately owned company that that had, I want to say, like $1 billion of premium at the time. It's probably significantly larger now. Really interesting company that focused in the Northeast and had every distribution system. They have independent agents, they have captive agents, they have a direct business. And the opportunity was to basically find new ways to grow the operation, find a new path forward for the independent agency business, for other use cases. And we did probably the coolest stuff in insurance that maybe has ever been done in the insurance industry. We put baseball benefits on an auto insurance policy, football benefits on a home insurance policy. We like created the co-branded credit card methodology of of auto insurance. And I don't think it's been duplicated to this point, which is shocking to me because the all of that work was super interesting. To how do you differentiate the offering on a pretty commoditized industry? I'm not saying the product itself is commoditized. It's not. But the industry, a lot of the approaches the industry takes are similar across brands and businesses. So for Plymouth Rock to step out at that time and had an amazing management and leadership team. Chris Oley was the president of the independent agency business at that time. Keith Jensen was the chief marketing officer, and I worked closely with both of them. And what happened during that period of time was thinking significantly outside of the box of how do you grow a business.
What year around was that? When was that roughly?
2013, I think,
okay,
is when,
yeah,
when I was there.
That makes sense, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah. It's awesome. I mean, that was what I remember. Like, Plymouth Rock was doing all kinds of stuff back then. And they did a ton of stuff within the Salesforce world. That's how I got to know them. I spent a ton of time with those guys back in the day. And
there was a
lot of companies
team.
That spun out of, like, a lot of people that were there kind of spun out and did startups, and they really kind of really did a lot within our industry. It's cool.
Well, I mean, I'm in that story. So I didn't start CMT by any means, but I joined when the company had 42 people and before the company had significant outside funding. And I remember how like nerve-wracking it was to leave because the thing that I think is challenging is when you get into a quote unquote career path, I think it's a misnomer. I don't think there are career paths. I think there are achievements and there are things that lead to each other, but there's no path. Like you have a path as much as you have a chainsaw, and you cut your way through a forest to figure it out. And, what was interesting was like I really, really wrestled with the decision to leave Plymouth Rock and join a startup at that time, which it absolutely was a startup, but they had been around for a long time. But the telematics world was not what it is today, because at Plymouth Rock, we were doing so many cool things. Like we were doing so many amazing, innovative things in the insurance industry for a small company with a small group of people, that it was very challenging to leave. But the opportunity at CMT was so significant. And I started to see the actual product that CMT was making create a huge competitive advantage, because I was part of the team that built something called Road Rewards, which is Plymouth Rock's telematics program that is basically rewarding drivers for being safe. So it's not a premium discount program. It's an app on the phone that if you do things that are safe, it gives you discounts on gas. It gives you free Starbucks, free movie tickets, Amazon gift cards, all that stuff. And when I was at Plymouth Rock, I had negotiated all those deals with outside entities. I had studied other programs. In fact, this is modeled very heavily on a program called Vitality Drive from Discovery Insure, a South African company. I remember I was pleading with my peers at Plymouth Rock, and I if they listen to this, it'll be funny. But I was like, I need to go to South Africa. And imagine working for a Northeast regional insurance company and like trying to lobby to go to South Africa. They're like, no, you're not going to South Africa. But I did eventually get to South Africa, by the way, with CMT. But like I was learning, like I was taking all this information in. And this is like the time period in insurance and insurance tech where insurance tech wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
I went to the first OnRamp conference, which I think was like OnRamp was, to me at least, the first insurance technology conference that existed. I remember Sheffy and Avi were the MCs for the event. It was in Chicago. So it was either the first, maybe it was the second, but it was big. There were like 300 people there. And in that room, I bet if you go back to that attendee list, I bet all those people are doing super cool stuff, because it was the first movement of people realizing that the technology is so incredibly overinvested in 1988 technology that there's a huge opportunity to do something new. And it was before the mega conferences. Like this was a small focus thing, one day in and out. And it was a super, I would say, very intense kind of period in time in the industry, because it was before all the venture funding. It was before all of the kind of attention. I don't think anybody was really paying attention to what was happening. FinTech was starting to bubble up a little bit, but not much. And at that period of time, what we were doing with Robo Rewards was pretty revolutionary. We had to get insurance filings. We had to get regulators to say it was okay to give something to our clients, which, you know, could be construed as rebating underneath some of the language. So we had to, you know, go out and convince the Massachusetts DOI and Connecticut and I think Pennsylvania at the time and New York and, you know, in our backs and backyard. And that work was really kind of, I would say, fascinating, because it wasn't just the partnerships that we negotiated. It wasn't just the business model that we had to create internally to figure out what we're going to set the reward amounts at and how we're going to distribute it. It wasn't just the technology. It was, you know, also coordinating in all the regulatory pieces too. So, you know, that period of time was also one of those elements where it's hard to replicate, because there was no road at that point, right? It wasn't like we could just reference something that already existed. And most of the stuff was done inside of Plymouth Rock at that point, but we did have amazing support on the technology side from CMT, and I started to work with them. So I started to become really, really familiar with the people there. And I want to say the company was like 30 or 40 people at that point. I think that I was number 42 when I joined. So I, you know, brought my immediate prior experience of doing something that was totally outside of the normal kind of approach in the insurance industry over to CMT. But at that time, when I joined CMT, I had claims experience. I had distribution experience with agency partners. I had experience on the regulatory side of getting crazy stuff approved and building the business case internally and getting financing and putting it all together and then getting it out in market. And I think it was the perfect, you know, combination of things at that time. But if you ever told me that I would work for a tech company, I would have told you you're crazy, because I still remember, like, I still remember sitting outside of Liverpool, New York, the headquarters, the claims office for Hanover and Syracuse, on my lunch break, listening to This Week in Tech, which is a podcast that was by Leo Laporte, used to be the tech guy on tech TV. Like, I was always like into technology, and he was broadcasting from CES, or he was recording from CES. I'm like, this sounds like the coolest thing ever. And I was like, man, how cool would it be to get a job in tech and be able to do that? And I think I've been to every CES since 2019 at this point, and beyond. And it is, if you ever told me before then, I would have no even thought that it would be possible. But all that experience that I was accumulating then turned out to be super useful, because CMT doesn't just build programs that measure driver behavior. We're also detecting crashes. We're sending emergency support to the scene. We're reconstructing crashes, and the claim side of the business is as big as anything else. So it is fascinating to me to, in that period of time, I felt like I was totally like, I was like, just, I would get 10 claims a day, work through those. I think I had like 2 weeks of vacation time. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm like, man, this is it. Like, we work all this time in college and in high school and all the work you do to get to a job. And your job is literally like this in and out processing thing. And you get so little vacation time. So this is where I'm spending my life. And I think I was like low key depressed at that point. And man, I'll tell you what, now, like, I talk to people that are like in, you know, super advanced positions in, you know, some of these different verticals that don't really have the hands-on experience of doing the thing that their tech actually is doing. And they're making huge decisions on behalf of the organization, and they have to like talk to, you know, up and down to get a perspective. And I was fortunate enough to have that, but I was not happy by any means with that opportunity at that time.
Wow. Wow. So talk to us about Cambridge, CMT, as you say. Talk to us about that. So telematics, right? First, I know, like, if I just going off of memory, and you're probably going to choke me out here, but like, telematics became a thing to me as an agent with Snapshot, right? Progressive. And but was Allstate first, if I recall? Was Allstate?
No.
Okay.
No, I think this is like documented. So Progressive had something called Autograph before that. And I think it was in the 90s. So Progressive.
That? Yeah.
So it was like, it was a project at that time in the company that they said, we don't care what it costs. We're going to get data from a car. And I think it was in the 90s. I'm pretty sure I know the people that were involved in it, but I don't want to get it wrong. So I won't step on myself here, but Progressive is one of those companies similar to Plymouth Rock, obviously significantly different scale, but Progressive was a company that, and still is a company that invests a lot in things that are, you know, way outside the box, and Autograph was it. So Autograph was the start. So their whole idea was, we think that if we get information from the car in some way, shape, or form, that we'll be able to better predict crash risk. Can we predict crash risk in this way? Are there other variables? And if you look at what the insurance ecosystem has at its disposal in order to set rates, like almost none of it is based on the actual activity itself. It's all proxies. So the financial responsibility is a proxy, credit score. Where somebody lives is a proxy for congestion or where they're driving. So their zip code, their motor vehicle record is a proxy for how they drive. But, you know, that's not necessarily how they drive right now. That's how they drove while a cop was around and decided to write a ticket. And then their ability to effectively plead it down below the level that it shows on an MVR or not. Right. So you actually look at this and you think about it. It's actually sort of crazy. It's sort of crazy that you have like all this premium that's based on elements that are proxy variables. But you have to. Well, what else are you going to do? I mean, all the way back from whenever the first insurance policy was written on auto, maybe it was Travelers. I don't know exactly. But that first auto insurance policy that's written, maybe State Farm, actually. But anyway, the first policy that's written and you don't have, how do you know? Right. So then you can continue to scale. So Progressive at that time had launched the program. So the first incantations were like the cost to get the data was probably like $2,000 per car. So obviously not a scalable solution. But then what happened, and this is a seminal moment. So the California Air Resources Board mandated that the OBD2 port on a car become standardized for smog inspections. Talk about things that are like totally unrelated, right? So CARB mandates that the OBD2 port is a standardized, it has a standardized output. So now all the cars sold in California have an OBD2 port, which also means all cars sold everywhere else because you have, you know, 42 million people live in California, its own little country. So they have the ability through their regulations to seriously steer a lot of activity. So the insurance industry at that point has already been toying around with this. And I'm pretty sure, I don't 100% know this, but I'm pretty sure that Progressive was first to market with an OBD2 product. Yeah. So at that time, they would mail out the OBD2. You would have to plug it into your car. It would keep it in there for some period of time, unplug it, put it back in an envelope and mail it back. And then some person, the company, gets these every day, figures out the policy number, pulls the data off and like presses, you know, plus or minus in the premium system. And then, you know, OBD2 got a little bit more sophisticated. Some of them got connected to the cell network. So they didn't have to start to send those out. And when I got involved in telematics, that's exactly what it was. That is exactly what it was. And I hated it, like literally hated it. I was responsible at Plymouth Rock during the period of time of getting agents to get involved in usage-based insurance.
Yeah.
And like, I was probably very incantankerous about this entire idea. We were, I think at one point, giving agents $50 to plug it into their own car. And I think that we had made some error somehow, and we had killed a whole bunch of batteries when I was at Plymouth Rock because like there was like a pin setting or something that was incorrect.
What you put in like wasn't right. It like shorted
out
the battery.
It wasn't right. Yeah. And to make it even better, imagine doing that read to your best agents, the ones you have relationships with, to ask them to do things.
Jesus.
And I think that it actually happened to our chief marketing officers too. So I think that it happened like when he was at he flew somewhere and his car was at the airport and it was sitting in there, came back, car was dead.
Oh no.
So I hated telematics. I thought it was the stupidest thing ever. And I still think that error was like full of issues. By the way, some parts of the world are still like super over indexed on OBD2 and hardware, but we can talk about that later. CMT is a global company. So I get to see all sorts of parts of the world. So anyway, that period of time, was expensive for carriers. So the business models were super tight. They didn't have a lot of like benefit to consumers to opt in because it wasn't a scalable solution when you need to involve this kind of level of not only like the hardware itself, but the support level for it too.
Yeah.
In fact, if you go to some carriers still use it, you can go and find a website where you can find like a very in-depth instruction manual on how to find where your OBD2 port is. And if you drive a Tesla or a Rivian or a Ford F-150 Lightning, it doesn't exist because, again, that port is only there because of CARB. That's why that port is there. Still, to this day, that's why that port exists.
Wow.
And Teslas are not obviously part of the smog check. So anyway, that technology is a period piece. At this point, if there's a telematics museum, it will be there at some point. But during that period of time, it was huge. It was huge. So what happened was CMT, and this is way before me, it was after the car crashing and dropping out of high school period of my life. So maybe in the early insurance days, in that period of time, I looked back at what CMT was doing. And it was started by two professors at MIT, Hari Balakrishnan and Sam Madden. They're still professors there. In fact, Hari just won the Marconi Prize, which is like the Nobel Prize of the internet, so to speak. When he was awarded this prize, the guy, Vin Cerf, that literally invented the internet, was also awarded a lifetime achievement. Wow. So the Marconi Prize, for those in the kind of like technology, Ethernet, sensing world, all the stuff that we need to do this podcast, like the foundational stuff of the internet. So Hari was working on that for a long time, and Sam was as well. Sam was in the early days of AI and database structure, and they both teach at MIT. And they're like amazing teachers, incredible teachers. So they were working on this technology that their first kind of use case was detecting potholes. So people were driving around, they were hitting potholes around the city of Austin. The sensors at that point, it was before smartphones, but they were using phones that had accelerometers in them. So like, think about like the Snickers phone or the Razor, like that period of time, Nokia phones, like they started to put accelerometers in them for games or other things. So they realized that they could take that data and make sense of it. And what they were doing got the attention of the insurance industry because they said, well, if you can detect potholes, maybe you can detect the same kind of thing that we're doing in this super expensive hardware driven environment. And they connected with Bill Powers, who had already had been very successful in the traffic industry and had done a number of startups and sold businesses and eventually brought businesses public. And they originally thought that the business was going to be around traffic. So the first name for the company was going to be Traffic RNA. Turns out to be RNA became very popular a few years ago. That name got shelved and it became Cambridge Mobile Telematics. And then the insurance industry started to realize that the same stuff that they were doing on the hardware side could be done on software. The first company that figured that out was State Farm. So State Farm was really one of the first that started to dabble in mobile telematics, which today is, it really was like a catalyst event because it created a very low cost way to gather individual driver behavior. And then it created all these business models that forked off from it that go down to reward programs, driver improvement, core usage-based insurance, tons of different things, crash detection. None of that would be possible if the technology was taking up, you know, all this cost, because the technology then, you know, that cost then shrinks down significantly. And now there's all these new business models that you can create. So the tech was the catalyst really a whole industry kind of taking off.
But I feel like, you know, so back in the day, like when we'd sell like the snapshot or whatever, you wouldn't really sell it. You'd kind of promote it to customers because it was good for retention purposes if they did the whole thing. But like plugging it in, if I remember correctly, this is like years and years and years ago, but a lot of what they watched was like braking, how much people brake and how hard they brake, I guess, to show congestion, where they're at, and just like speed up, slow down. But it wasn't necessarily watching like speed and whatnot. I wonder, like, now, like, so if I'm plugging in to the OB2, I'm seeing like the throttle and like all of it and whatnot. But I would assume on the mobile device, you know, you can see speed and maybe you can see like breaking in that way, but I would almost assume that it'd be better to be plugged in. No?
Maybe. I think that what happened, though, was the programs that were plugged in were only measuring limited variables, but more important, for a limited period of time.
Oh, yeah. So, true, 'cause you'd send it in like 2 months later. Right?
2 months later. I mean, experimented.
I would tell customers, like, oh, just drive real good for the next couple of months, like this kind of thing. Seriously.
Yeah. By the way, there are still companies that were doing that. So like if you were an agent in March 2020 and you sold that with those short-term monitoring programs, those people, like in some cases, have lifetime discounts depending on the way that the carrier was set up. So like there are some people sitting on like the 2% mortgage interest rate equivalent of a UBI score from March 2020, April, May, that kind of thing. But what happened is the industry started to realize this technology is substantially cheaper. And we can monitor continuously. So with the early days, an individual's driving behavior, like the thought was that people don't change. So if you can look at them for a period of time, you got it. Like that's how they are. That is totally not the case. Like that is 100% absolutely not the case. In fact, if you signed up to be a gig driver right now, what we have measured is your time that you're spending on the app could actually change your risk profile immediately. Because the nature of their task, the context, where you drive, why you drive there, the road around you, the conditions of other drivers, all of that stuff factors into your own individual driving risk. So there are really no safe and unsafe drivers, even though that the nomenclature and a lot of the work that goes into it is like, oh, this is a good or bad risk. That's like for the moment. But like I was a terrible student in high school, but turned it around in college. People can have bad moments of time that don't exhibit the way that they drive continuously. And if you give feedback to drivers, and here's the big thing that none of that stuff did, it didn't tell you how you were doing. Like on the whole, you didn't really know how you're doing. It's just like this thing that's out there.
Yeah, totally.
And it's like stepping on a scale that doesn't have like a number to it. So you just keep stepping on it and I'm doing the thing. Great. You know, and you're like, why doesn't my pants fit anymore? Right. So like, if you have the ability to create this closed ecosystem where you're measuring the behavior, you know that behavior is predictive, you continue to expand the universe of elements that are predictive to that, you provide feedback to drivers to that and to that that approach, and incentives and structures that then allow that person to maximize their own personal financial condition. So now you're tying driving to their finances. Now you're tying driving to some positive element, not just not getting caught. So no. It has changed the dynamic considerably. And what really the tech has done is given the insurer the ability to not only predict price and crash risk, but actually change it and reduce crash risk and actually fundamentally make roads safer. So now where we're at is the foundation of the company, by the way, the mission of the company, CMT, is to make the world's roads and drivers safer. And you can do that if you give feedback. You can do that if there's incentives. You can do that if you're accurately measuring risk. You can't do that in this in this headless environment. So yeah, there may be tons and tons and tons of factors that, you know, the more data that's out there, the more you understand what leads to a crash prior to a crash. What I can tell you is what we have found is that, yes, hard braking is, if you are a constant regular hard braker, that is indicative of future crash risk, because what you're doing is you're not allowing yourself enough time to adapt to things that happen around you. And that is like a huge issue. If you don't have enough time, it's like if you're playing baseball and you're not looking at the pitch and you're just waiting for the sound of the bat, it's already over. The ball is already past you. And some people don't know that they are not as good at that. Okay. They just don't know. And it's funny because if you ask drivers, if you go out and survey drivers, and this happens over and over and over again, it's like official stuff. 90% of drivers say they're better than average. How do people get feedback? They either get stopped, they have someone in their car that gives them feedback. And by the way, nobody takes that well, right? The backseat driver. No one's like, oh, thank you so much. You know what? You're so right. Or another driver decides to give you a hand signal to inform you of your quality of your driving. And that's it. If you don't get feedback, you don't know. And the driving, you know, learning process sort of ends at 16. And then you're like thrown to the wolves. So over a long period of time, you don't think that even Max Verstappen is like studying every single one of his movements. And when it comes to us, it is the number one killer of people from young age to like, you know, mid to late 30s.
before other diseases catch up. It is literally the number one killer, just getting into a car. So, you know, it's just like this totally divorced component that is a problem. And the more that we can do to connect these financial incentives and feedback, then you can change it. So that's sort of what changed in the last, I would say, 4 to 5 years.
So in the apps, and I haven't used one of these newer apps, probably a good thing in my case, but
you're paying too much for insurance if you're not. I can guarantee you.
But like in the app, is it really saying like, hey, this is like, is there like a meter there, if you will? Like, this is kind of where you're at. And if you were over here, if you made these changes, you know, hey, watch a little YouTube video on how to like not use your brakes as much, kind of thing. Like, is that like what we're talking about here?
Oh, absolutely. And you know, there's a wide variety. We have like 120 programs across the globe right now. It might be more than that. We bought two other telematics companies in the last 3 years. One was TrueMotion, another Boston-based company, and another is Emoto, which is based in Croatia. And, you know, in all of these programs around the world, there's lots of different variety in the ways that this goes through. But we were just at the Transportation Research Board. It was like the Super Bowl for transportation geeks. Yes. And we had a paper that was published in a presentation there about driver feedback. And it is definitive. The more the driver comes in and looks at their trips, the more that they reduce crash risk. And we have one of our customers that's reduced frequency 25%. And, you know, they're experts at it, global experts at it. So like, it's not, there's not a
25%. That's massive.
25% for sure. For sure. This is Discovery Insure, the company that I mentioned that Road Rewards was inspired by. Discovery Insure's whole ethos is shared value. What can we do as an insurance company to put ourselves in the same position as our customer to reduce crash risk or to reduce risk overall, whatever that risk is? They have lots of different business units. And, you know, what's happened is there's now behavioral scientists that are working on this. It's not just actuaries. You know, we have actuaries, we have data scientists, we have behavioral scientists. The insurance companies have these things now too. Insurance companies are now connecting more with the road safety community. Progressive sponsored a study that happened at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia. I mean, there's like really cool stuff about researching what type of feedback, how often, what type of information. We have a thing in market called hard brake alerts that gives feedback to drivers audibly that tells drivers that we detected a hard brake. And that helps people understand not just like the in-app feedback, but real time that there's some information. We have other stuff that's like that too. So really it's a transition away from it. It didn't start like this. It started as a pricing tool to do better than all the proxy stuff that exists out there. And what happened was over time, people realized that not only can we predict crash risk, but we can actually change it. And man, if you can change it, this is from a Wall Street Report a few years ago from Mike Zaremski, who was at Credit Suisse at the time, is now at Bank of Montreal. He said that if Progressive reduced frequency by 1% reduction in frequency, they increase earnings per share by 9%. And this is, you know, when Progressive was under $100. So from an investment standpoint, when you realize this, the real challenge is how do you get more drivers to engage in these programs?
Yeah,
how do you get more drivers to engage in these programs? And that is still not a solved issue. Still not a solved issue, especially in agents.
Yeah, no kidding. Because you still have to convince the insured to get the app and do the app and follow along with it, right?
Here's the thing that is universal truth. For whatever reason, the bulk of the independent agents are not as, I don't know if it's confident or crisp in explaining how this works to a consumer as that conversation goes with a direct conversation or a captive agent. And I think maybe it's because there's maybe too many options and there's a lot of detail. And as someone that came from the IA world and spent a long time in it, you know, I have tremendous amount of respect with tons of friends that are still independent agents. And what I would say is that it's just the data. If you look at, are people favorable to this approach? Do you want control of your insurance price? Do you want more capability to determine what you pay? Do you want feedback on the things that filter into this? Are you open to this technology? The numbers are like 80 plus surveyed by us, JD Power, you know, number of different times, continue repeated. And that number keeps climbing, by the way, keeps climbing. Then people that are asked, are you willing to opt in? That number, are you favorable? That's number one. The second thing is,
you know, actually are, when you're asked, do you opt in, the take rate, so to speak, that number is like 70%, 75%. So the number one problem is that consumer awareness is high when people shop directly with the company or with captive agent. Consumer awareness is really low and independent agent. So I don't think that consumers are being asked. I don't think that they're being asked. And I think that that's the number one issue, that that conversation is not happening in IAs because there is enough carrier mix that they can get to around the right price without taking every single step necessary to get someone the absolute bottom line best price. That's no knock on it. It's probably one of the advantages of the system that there is so much variability or inefficiency between companies. But what's happening though is the carriers that are invested in their telematics programs, they're growing incredibly fast and they know so much more about risk. So go back to the first part of the conversation. Imagine you're looking at your company and you're just basing your data off of proxy variables. And then you have another company, it's the first party data. It's first party data. So you know something the rest of the market does not know. And now you have a direct relationship with that consumer and can actually change and shape that risk and reduce crash risk. Your prices over time in that particular segment are going to continue to get better and better and better. And the people that don't take advantage of that feedback and they, you know, choose to drive dangerously, and that's really what we're talking about. We're not talking about people that don't toe the line. We're talking about people that drive dangerously. And I can talk about this because, like we talked about before, I have been there. I drove dangerously. I flipped a car. I, you know, was brought in an ambulance to the hospital. And I saw people drive dangerously as an EMT. So this is not about like people driving perfect. This is about people that drive dangerously. And if people choose to drive dangerously, then they might pay more for insurance. They won't engage in a telematics program. They'll go to a carrier that doesn't have it. And over time, it's like little by little, like taking 1 grand of sand off the beach and just putting it on to a scale. And over time, that's just going to create a massive imbalance for independent agents and independent agent carriers. And I think it's a major issue. And it's not that consumers aren't interested in it. It's that agents haven't really embraced it as much as other distribution channels. Sure. Because companies like Nationwide have great programs. That program is fantastic. 15% upfront discount as a consumer. And that program is reducing distracted driving. And Nationwide is doing a ton of work. So like, it's not like these programs don't exist or they're not well architected. They are. But generally speaking, across all of the if you just weigh the three channels, the independent agency distribution just is not as engaged in telematics as others. And I think partially, Reed, it's because of the first part of the conversation. The first tech that came out was not good, right? Mm. Like the first utility of the approach. I don't think, my personal opinion is, I mean, I hated it. I personally did not like it. And I can't imagine if I was an agent trying to continue to try to find someone's OBD port and, you know, trying to put my head under in a car and tripping over McDonald's French fries while doing it, I'd just be done with it. And I think that today's telematics is so, so, so different than what was out, you know, a decade ago.
But like, let's get down to the brass tacks here. Like, how much could I save? You know, like, really?
Some carriers are 40%. I mean, it depends.
40%? Like, I didn't know that. See, like the snapshot stuff back in the day was like, I think it was like maybe 15, you know, max.
The start is 15. So the upfront discount, your upfront, the minute you switch is 15. And then you see the meter and it shows you how you're driving and it shows you your areas to improve. I'm not speaking about Progressive specifically. I'm speaking overall. Nationwide's program is 15%. State Farm's program is 10%. I think Traveler's program is 10 or 15. I can't remember, but it's, to the point now, 24 of the top 25 carriers have programs like this. Yes. And the majority of those programs are continuous. And what's happened is like gradually the variables that are produced from an individual's driving behavior are so clearly more predictive of crash risk that they just slowly replace. So what's happening is if you take a dollar bill and you just like fold that up to the point of what part is coming from proxy and what comes from direct risk, the more that you can, you know, continue to make that dollar bill representative of direct risk, it's going to mean that that carrier is going to be more profitable because the carrier is actually pricing relative to the environment around them and where they are. And every company that has had telematics programs has had the ability for that particular book of business to match rate to risk if they're continually updating this technology, they're continually updating the scoring data. If you only take it in a small period of time, at a snapshot period, then it's not going to update. You're not going to have that advantage. But oh, by the way, snapshot doesn't work like that anymore. Snapshot's now continuous. So, you know, that's really what's changed. Is it used to just be like this like tiny little corner of the dollar bill. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's not half, but it's working its way there because it has more representation of the actual risk that's observed. And it's over the life of the policy. So that's really what's changed.
Yeah. Wow. That's fascinating, man. That's super cool. I had no idea about all of that. I mean, I kind of knew, but, you know, not like that. It's pretty cool. So what's the future of it? What's next?
I mean, the biggest next step, it's already happened. So more and more of consumers are connected to crash detection in real time, which is awesome. Progressive talked about this on their earnings call last year, just about a year ago. What they have done is they've made crash detection available to anybody in their app. You don't even have to be a part of Snapshot. So if you have the Progressive app, you can opt into this, and that benefit is significant because people pay money for crash detection services. OnStar, for example, it's like $30 a month. If you get into a crash and you need emergency support, emergency help, you know, if it's a observed crash, you can just call, someone else is calling 911 for you, or if you can reach your phone, you call 911. But a lot of crashes aren't observed. And these crashes happen at night, they happen in rural areas, they happen during a snowstorm, somebody goes off the road. Now what's happening is the insurance company is actually acting as a guardian angel, which is super cool. That's a major evolution. So the insurance company is moving from this era of time of reactive to everything, reactive to proactive. And the more that shift happens, the more that the services that are provided to consumers are better. They're just providing better services, and they're actually serving a different purpose in life. And agents are too. So agents that are helping people get to this point are now giving their customers this this guardian angel service, right? It's amazing. What now also occurs as a former claims guy is now that crash data is available through digital technology. So when I get somebody that calls in, I now have all the information that I need to start that claim. And sometimes that's all you need to get it started. So you need to get the, you know, where it happened, when it happened, confirm coverage, help that facility up. You know, is it a total loss? Let's get it immediately over to a salvage yard instead of having it accrue costs at a body shop. Let's not tow that thing three times. Let's get the whole claim handled so I can give the money back to the consumer faster if it's a total, or let me get this car back to the person, because literally nobody wants their car in the shop. No, especially now, those rental cars are not, they're like 50,000 miles on them. So what's happened is it really is just facilitating the digital kind of transformation is facilitating this move from reactive to proactive. And this change is permeating the risk side. It's permeating the crash side. And eventually, I think that we'll get to the point where, you know, drivers will have this other places outside of insurance. I think that at some point, your driver's license, when you're going through the permitting process, your test will be, or your record up to your test will be digital. Like if anybody plays games like Gran Turismo or Forza, it's harder to get a license in those games. Those are racing games on Xbox and PlayStation 5. It's harder to get a license in those games than it is in real life because all of the data is there. So you have to continue. You have to drive like safely a number of times. So it's analog.
Like, freaking annoying, man. Like, you know, like.
Dude, trust me. I mean, I think, you know, just that one little last thing and you just hit the curve.
It's hard. It really is hard. But no, it's so true. It's so true.
So I think what's going to happen is all of this, this approach of being able to connect the thing that we're trying to achieve to data. Data is already part of our life in so many different areas, but like giving it to the consumer, giving more tools to the consumer so that the consumer can help facilitate that person can learn driving from an agnostic, from a simple approach, as opposed to learning it from, you know, maybe whoever has access to a car or their mom or dad. Like over time, what we're doing is just bringing more tools and technology to the approaches of things that have been a part of our life for a long time that have been analog. And it's really been missing from mobility. It's been missing from our car. You know, I could talk to you for another, you know, hour about what's happening on road safety and how people that make policy decisions decide to invest dollars in that and the data that they have. You know, the way that distracted driving is analyzed right now is by a survey on the side of the road. And, you know, that's because that was the best technology approach at the time when someone said, how many people are distracted? So what's happened over time is like, we've just evolved so many things to bring digital technology and data, and it just makes sense. And I think the most important thing, Reed, like literally the most important thing, is giving consumer control. This should not be headless. The consumer should know, because a lot of the stuff is controllable. And if it's controllable, if we can control this, then you can actually reduce risk, which is in the total best interest of the insurance carrier and in the best interest of the person that's engaged and of society, people you share the road with. So that's where we're headed. And I think it's got to be favorable to consumer. You know, we have to create technology that's simple, that's clear, and that helps the consumer, you know, manage their risk, their economics, and make it approachable. And, you know, the less it looks like the OBD2 from that, you know, early day, which was great and super important to move the industry along, the more that I think people will be excited about the ability to actually understand it versus, you know, looking at it through a lens of a black box.
That's awesome, man. I got a question for you. If you could change one thing in the insurance industry, what would you change?
I think more underwriting factors and variables that are first party, that are directly related to the risk, and less third party data. That's my personal view.
Why aren't they, though? I mean, if it's in the best interest of the carrier, going back to kind of your dollar example, right? And the like Progressive $1 equals $9, right? In shareholder value. Why wouldn't they? Or are they?
It's the data. It's not available. So all of the telematics data, you know, or the majority, not all, but the majority of the telematics data used is created by the consumer on an opt-in basis, which is good. I think it needs to be an opt-in basis. I think the consumer needs control over it, but the data is just not there. So there's no alternative. So third-party data becomes the only other solution because the data is not there. And, you know, you can't have like a price for everybody that's homogeneous, because then, you know, you're going to end up charging people crazy rates. It's been tried. It's, you know, that has been tried multiple times. And I don't think it's a good model at all. So you do need to have a basis to differentiate risk on. You absolutely do. You need to be able to look at elements that cause loss, change those. And if you don't have the data yourself, where in the world are you going to get it? So to me, it's a distribution problem. And I think at some point it will be this period of time will be, you know, I think we look back on like, wow, I can't believe we used a price like this. There's so many different things that are so much more related to the actual risk. But I don't begrudge the carriers for doing this, or the people that are in this. They have no other option. And you can't just, there's no utility in saying, okay, we're going to charge every single person the same, because that even gets us further away from the issue of matching rates of risk. So we need to match rates of risk. But I think, if you're asking me personally, more first party data and more consumer control, that will lower costs, because any time that you as a consumer are not directly involved in the elements of what you pay and the components of what you pay for it, you're paying too much. You're just like absolutely paying too much. That's probably the problem with healthcare, where, you know, you don't really negotiate, you don't really know, you can't really control your healthcare costs, you know, directly, because there's a lot of things that happen in between. You can 100% control if you get into a crash or not, if you are responsible for that crash. Each crash occurs because some human error occurred. They don't just like randomly happen. They don't just pop out of a cake. Literally, the system that works on the grid, the traffic network, works fantastic if everyone obeys the rules. People don't. So in that environment where individual decisions drive whether or not there is a crash or a loss, then we need more tools to actually manage that, to differentiate against that, to reduce it. And then eventually, I think the idea of pricing on things that aren't that is going to literally sound archaic.
Sure.
That's awesome, man. I could totally see it. So good. This is all so fascinating. I'm gonna transition on. I want to learn a little bit about you, a little bit more. Let's get into a little leadership stuff, if that's okay.
For sure.
So tell me, what does a leader mean to you?
I think someone that helps you be your best, like your best, not their best, but your best, because every person has skills that they can contribute that are unique to them. And I think that the more that there are individuals that can help people become that for themselves, the better that will work. I think the challenge is that sometimes people don't even know what that is. So sometimes leadership is hard to you can't manufacture it. So every environment and scenario can't necessarily have leadership. And I think that's a bit of a misnomer that we're always going to have leadership and leadership. You know, sometimes you have management, you know, management is just the controls of functions. Management isn't leadership. It's not the same thing. Leadership is about the subject, not the person that is doing the activity, I think.
When in your career did you realize you were a leader? Or do you believe that you're a leader?
Yeah, I don't know. It depends on the context. I would say that in some aspects, I think what's actually the biggest change that I've seen in myself where I feel comfortable saying that I am a leader is when I put forward ideas or concepts or approaches that have helped to resonate and move things forward, whether it's the idea or how or a person. And it's at that point that I look back and I've exhibited leadership, but I don't think I personally am a leader. I think that you exhibit leadership in particular times. And then at other times you find yourself as a killer wingman or woman. I think that if you always think that you are the leader, then you're going to quickly fall into a scenario where it's about your ideas, not about what's right. So I don't think that I'm like a leader, so to speak. I do think that I have leadership on a lot of cool things. And I've been really fortunate to be with people that have allowed me to bring, you know, the best out of them too, right? It's a two-way street. And I've worked with people at CMT, outside of CMT, that I've been super impressed with how they have brought their skills and to a point where they are contributing way more than I think they even thought when they started in whatever kind of endeavor it is. But I don't feel comfortable just saying that I'm a leader, but I do think that I've had opportunities to exhibit leadership and the verb active as opposed to the noun definition. And when I don't have the ability to be the leader, I'm happy to be in the flock and helping execute other people's excellent visions. You know, sometimes I have them, sometimes other people do.
That's great. That's great. How do you define success?
Oh man, that's a tough one. I think it's super context dependent. Sometimes success is based on getting a policy change. Like when I first started, telematics was not able to be used in New York. It was not mobile telematics was not allowed by the New York State Department of Financial Services. It wasn't allowed in Massachusetts. And one of the things that I personally set out is I want to make it so consumers can choose the opportunity of these programs. And you know, what do I need to do that? We did that. It's awesome. And you know, there's those type of opportunities are obvious, right? Because there's a clear goal and it's a clear win. But sometimes success is like 5 years ago, we didn't publish any research really at all on the analysis that we had. And I created the first distracted driving report that we built at CMT. And now we're working on, I think, the fifth iteration at this point. That is now being used by advocates to get laws changed. It's being used by departments of transportation to assess the success of their ability. Like that to me, you know, when I'm using the definition in my answer, but like it's some stuff is so long tailed that it's very clear that it's hard to, you know, you lose a little bit of the initial piece, but success is contextual. You know, what are you trying to accomplish at any given time? And sometimes success means, you know, just an iterative tiny step on getting there. And some people get way too lost at the end goal. And it is very hard to get to the end goal. Like if you're trying to lose 20 pounds, 1 pound is freaking cause for celebration and success. You just have to start somewhere. And the biggest thing is like the hardest thing to do, I think, in life is to start on big, challenging things. But man, I hate working on small stuff. Like I only want to work on big things. And Bill Bowers, who's the CMT CEO, and co-founder, he's like, don't play small so that others can play big. He's like, work on big things, impactful things. And he has, you know, done amazing work of getting a company from, you know, this research idea and awesome technology to the point now that he created an entire industry. That is success, right? For me, it's big stuff. And it doesn't mean like big stuff just to swing for home runs. Yeah, sometimes big means just getting around the bases and scoring a run, and the process is just getting on base. So it's man, it's contextual.
That's awesome. What a great answer. How do you give back?
Well, one of the biggest things that I focused on is one of the hardest things. I work a lot with advocates that that have lost loved ones from road crashes. And I have spent a lot of time with individuals that are making a big impact and changing laws that are much bigger than the insurance industry. You know, if they can actually make roads safer for every single person with the stroke of a pen, like what happened in Michigan last year, and in Ohio, and in Alabama, and Missouri, are huge issues. They passed hands-free laws, and we know that passing hands-free laws, while they're not the silver bullet,
what's a hands-free law? What does that mean?
You can't use your phone while you drive. So if you're if you have a phone in your hand while you drive, depending on the state, it's a primary offense, like not wearing your seatbelt or speeding, and they can pull you over for it. And you just need that law so that you can start communicating to the public and you can start talking to them. So these laws don't do anything from a business perspective. It's not a CMT, you know, related component. But it means a tremendous amount to work with the people that are actually that they have been been unfortunately and irrevocably impacted by these scenarios. And from a personal perspective, I've seen it, you know, from a lot of different angles. And if I personally can make a difference on it, I absolutely feel obligated to do it. So it's not even like something that's like, oh, I'm giving back. It's like, this is obvious. It's like a compulsion. It needs to happen. So that's probably the biggest thing.
That's great. And that's big, man. That's really big. And that's impacting a lot of lives. That's really, really cool. It's really cool. So what do you do for fun, Ryan?
Well, I just turned 40. Oh. And my 40th birthday, I went backcountry snowboarding. And it was awesome. I was in British Columbia, and I've got a group of people around me that I've been able to do a lot of really cool stuff like that. And these are people that I've known from the insurance industry from forever. So the connection back to those early days of forming those friendships have stayed with me. So I had people that were, you know, in my and other rotation classes with me, you know, 18 years later or whatever it is. So that's fun. And I love the outside, man. I love getting outside as much as possible. And I realized that there was a period of my life that I was just like, this sounds like if I heard this from someone else, I would cringe, but I was literally just working. I didn't play golf. I didn't do anything. I spent no time engaged in things that were like for fun, that just barely for fun and just for me. Yeah, and I've been able to do that a little bit more in the last like, you know, few months. And it's hard because when you're at a super fast growing company, it is really hard to take. If you're a motivated person and you think about work in the shower, it's really hard to not just like, you know, do that one extra thing and put that trip off because you might have a work thing that pops up. And that's been a big part of my life, and I'm really happy for that, but also realize that life is like somewhat like an hourglass, and at some point the sand just stops. And if you over-index on any one part of your life, it's gonna make you filled with a whole bunch of regrets at some point. Maybe you won't even be able to think about those regrets because you don't even have the opportunity to. So I think it's important.
Wow, that's great. That's great. If you had unlimited time, what would you do?
But I also have unlimited money in that case.
Yeah, sure.
Oof, I don't know. I think I would.
I ask these questions. I don't even know the answer to that one.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I'd probably like build something super cool. Like I'd build something. I'd probably become like a I'd probably like just make music. I think I would learn how to produce music, and I would just be like a music producer, I think, because I love music. I think that's exactly what I would do.
Very cool. Last question. What's your drink of choice?
Oh boy. Tequila soda. I think tequila soda is, you know, it's like, my number one go-to standby. Yeah. Casamigos, Blanco, soda, ice, a little bit of lime.
Ooh, that sounds good. That sounds good right about now. Well, hey man, this was great. Fascinating stuff, Ryan. Really, really cool. I want to thank you so much for joining, man. It was really, really good.
Thank you, Reed. This was, I've done a fair number of podcasts. I don't think I've ever talked about this stuff. So I appreciate the opportunity to get a little bit into it and really let's solve the independent agency distribution thing. Can we do that at some point? Because that is, to me, there are a lot of good people out there that that are in that space that, like yourself, maybe have just not known about this stuff. Yeah. So maybe that's a step two at some point.
Starts with education, man. And I think a lot of people are going to get a lot out of this. It was a big education for me, and it will be for many, many others. Really cool.
Appreciate
especially
it.
Now, like, even for the consumers, when everybody's just bitching about premiums and whatnot, it's like, here you go, you know? And so
listen, the consumer price index was at 3.1, I think, last month, and right around the same thing. Half of a point from that was insurance price that went up 20% in the month of January and in December. So you could actually make the argument that if insurance prices weren't what they were, if roads were safer, then mortgage rates would be cheaper. So like we need to get on this, because insurance is now affecting so many people. And it's like, it's going to take a minute for it to calm the waters. So the only thing that's available is you get control over your premium. That's it.
It's great, man. Thanks again, dude. It's good stuff.
Appreciate it.
All right, we're back. Ryan McMahon. What'd you think, Kristen?
Well, I do have a soft spot for people that have ties to Massachusetts, but no, I loved his story. I loved that, similar to Deb, he got into insurance by one of these programs that the carriers have out there. So kudos to Hanover for bringing somebody into the industry that has stayed and is still providing value to the industry.
Totally.
It changed my perception of what telematics was.
Yeah, I'd say so. I just thought it was that thing you just plug into the car, you know? And like he said, you know, used to be you just plug it in and you hope that you're doing the right thing. He said, like, what did he say? He said something like it's like stepping on the scale and then the scale doesn't give you a number.
Yeah.
So you just keep doing it to hopefully it's doing something.
Hopefully your pants will fit better.
And then like, I mean, when I was an agent, I used to tell people, just drive really, really good. And I think I remember like one of the hacks was a lot of it was due to braking, like how much you were braking. It wasn't as much acceleration, but like hard braking, fast braking made you a riskier driver. So I used to just tell the insurance, like, drive really nice, really safe for 30 days, send it back in and you get a discount on your insurance.
That trusted advisor, Reed Holdsworth, insurance agent.
It worked.
I just like the connection into road safety. So to the point of, let's take this information to help advise drivers on how to be better drivers. I talked to some of the people over at Cambridge Mobile who will be at InsurTech Boston. They have an annual road safety survey. So it'll be interesting to hear and see some of the things that they're learning from the telematics information that they're getting within their organization.
Yeah, totally. I mean, it's potentially a really big impact to safety on the roads for people. I mean, just like the alerting and letting you know, and you know, what did he say? There's like no good or bad drivers, right? What did he say again? It's like no good or bad drivers. It's just the, put it in a really good way.
Good or bad risk, right? It's the risk that you're looking at.
Yeah, it's the risk itself. And it's not like people are trying to do this kind of stuff. Things just happen. And ones that are making these mistakes more often than not are the riskier drivers. And so why not put technology around them to help them understand that, you know? I mean, it's pretty game changing, I guess, in a way. And, you know, the cost of insurance using this kind of model and people that are actually really good drivers, it's like, why not? Why not give them a lower rate in a really crappy zip code, you know? Right?
Yeah, that's a whole nother episode about where you live impacting what you pay for insurance, right? So,
yeah, no, it's crazy. It's crazy. Dramatically different between zip codes, depending on where you're at. Yeah, I really liked Ryan. I really had a lot. He's got a lot of passion for this industry. His whole story and, you know, him at Plymouth Rock and all of it. He's got a lot of passion for this industry and really for road safety. You know, and he like, you know, like he said, you know, that his Fast and the Furious experience and him causing chaos with his own vehicle, right? And then really digging in there and trying to impact the world in this way. Kudos to him. Yeah. That's pretty cool.
To me, it gives him so much more credibility that, yeah, he's lived that, right? He was the person who was being a little crazy to the point of flipping a car, I think is what he said, right? And then now looking at it for his job and just trying to make everybody better, but also make insurance a little less expensive because you're utilizing technology to help.
I think it's good timing too. I mean, so many people are upset about the price of insurance right now because of the market. And, you know, especially on the personal line side, people are just over it. You know, and these are tools and things they can use. And for the agents listening to that, promote this stuff, guys. I mean, it helps with retention, you know, put it out there. I mean, I think it's good. Look, if I go to quote my insurance, you know, a year from now and I'm getting this great rate because I'm driving well, nobody's going to be able to compete with that. So why not? Why not promote it? And then if it's helping your insureds and helping, you know, people become safer drivers, that means it's safer for everybody else around them and around you as well. So I think it's a pretty good mission. Pretty cool.
Agreed. Well, on to the next one.
On to the next one. Many more to come. Stay tuned.
The Insurance Technology Podcast is a production of Ivins. Visit InsureTechPod.com to contact us, suggest a topic or guest for an upcoming show, and subscribe to be notified when our latest podcast is available. You can find all our episodes in your favorite podcast app. It's where you can also leave us a rating and a review that helps other people find the show. Thanks for listening.